Then the fighting, now largely polarized between France and the Empire, continued. Peace, when it came, was the result of negotiations begun during the winter of 1528 to 29 between Charles's aunt, Margaret of Savoy, and her sister-in-law, Louise, mother of King Francis. The two met at Cambrai on 5 July 1529, and the resulting treaty was signed in the first week of August. The Ladies' Peace, as it came to be called, confirmed Spanish rule in Italy. Francis renounced all his claims there, receiving in return a promise from Charles not to press the imperial claims to Burgundy. But Francis' allies in the League of Cognac were left entirely out of the reckoning, and were thus subsequently forced to accept the terms that Charles was to impose at the end of the year, terms which included, for Venice, the surrender of all her possessions in South Italy to the Spanish Kingdom of Naples. Francesco Maria Sforza was restored to Milan, though Charles reserved the right to garrison its citadel. The Medici, who had been expelled from Florence in 1527, were also restored, though it took a 10-month siege to effect the restoration, and the island of Malta was given in 1530 to the Knights of St. John. It was a sad and, to those who felt that the King of France had betrayed them, a shameful settlement, but at least it restored peace to Italy and put an end to a long and unedifying chapter in her history. A chapter which had begun with Charles VIII's invasion in 1494 and had brought the Italians nothing but devastation and destruction. To seal it all, Charles V crossed the Alps for the first time for his imperial coronation. This was not an indispensable ceremony. His grandfather, Maximilian, had done without it altogether, and Charles himself, since his coronation at Aachen, had been nearly 10 years on the throne without this final confirmation of his authority. The fact remained, nonetheless, that until the Pope had laid the crown on his head, his title of Holy Roman Emperor was technically unjustified. To one possessing so strong a sense of divine mission, both the title and the sacrament were important. Imperial coronations were traditionally performed in Rome. On landing at Genoa in mid-August 1529, however, Charles received reports of Suleiman's steady advance on Vienna, and at once decided that a journey so far down the peninsula at such a time would be folly. It would take too long, besides leaving him dangerously cut off in the event of a crisis. Messengers sped to Pope Clement, and it was agreed that in the circumstances the ceremony might be held in Bologna, a considerably more accessible city, which still remained firmly under papal control. Even then, the uncertainty was not over. While on his way to Bologna in September, Charles received an urgent appeal from his brother, Ferdinand, in Vienna, and almost canceled his coronation plans there and then. Only after long consideration did he decide not to do so. By the time he reached Vienna, either the city would have fallen or the Sultan would have retired for the winter. In either case, the small force that he had with him in Italy would have been insufficient to tip the scales. And so on 5 November 1529, Charles V made his formal entry into Bologna, where, in front of the Basilica of St. Petronio, Pope Clement waited to receive him. After a brief ceremony of welcome, the two retired to the Palazzo del Podesta, across the square, where neighboring apartments had been prepared for them. There was much to be done, many outstanding problems to be discussed and resolved before the coronation could take place. It was, after all, only 2 years since Papal Rome had been sacked by imperial troops, with Clement himself, a virtual prisoner of Charles, in the Castle San Angelo. Somehow, friendly relations had to be reestablished. Next, there were the individual peace treaties to be drawn up with all the Italian ex-enemies of the empire, chief among which, apart from the Pope himself, were Venice, Florence, and Milan. Only then, when peace had been finally consolidated throughout the peninsula, would Charles feel justified in kneeling before Clement to receive the imperial crown. Coronation Day was fixed on 24 February 1530, and invitations were dispatched to all the rulers of Christendom. Charles and Clement had given themselves a little under 4 months to settle the future of Italy. Surprisingly, it proved enough. Well before the day appointed, Charles had laid the foundations of a pan-Italian league, a league which testified to the spread of imperial power across the length and breadth of Italy, unparalleled for centuries past. And so the peace was signed. Clement's League of Cognac and Charles's Sack of Rome were alike forgotten, or at least dismissed from minds. And on 24 February 1530, in St. Petronio, Charles was first anointed and then received from the papal hands the sword, orb, scepter, and finally the crown of the Holy Roman Empire. Something of a cloud was cast over the proceedings when a makeshift wooden bridge linking the church with the palace collapsed just as the emperor's suite was passing across it. But when it was established that the many casualties included no one of serious importance, spirits quickly revived, and celebrations continued long into the night. It was the last time in history that a pope was to crown an emperor. On that day, the 700-year-old tradition, which had begun in 800 AD when Pope Leo III had laid the imperial crown on the head of Charlemagne, was brought to an end. The empire was by no means finished, but never again would it be received, even symbolically, from the hands of the vicar of Christ on earth. Chapter 15. Barbary and the Barbarossas. Since the beginning of time, men have preyed upon their fellows, and since the building of the first navigable ships, piracy had existed in the Mediterranean. Since the Dark Ages, it had been practiced by Christians and Muslims alike, with or without the excuse of war, and often with the clearest of consciences. To the Turks, the activities of the Knights of St. John during their years in Rhodes would have merited no other name, while Ferdinand and Isabella, after their defeat of the Kingdom of Granada, would hardly have seen the constant harassment of Spanish shipping by Muslim raiders from North Africa as an honorable continuation of the war on the part of the vanquished. Yet, such in the eyes of those raiders, it was. And as the 16th century got underway, so this harassment took on a new dimension. The Barbary, or Berber, coast became synonymous with piracy. After the first appearance of the Arabs nearly 900 years before, the North African coast, with the exception of Melilla, which had been occupied by the Spaniards in 1497 and remains to this day Spanish territory, had been controlled by the Umayyad, Abbasid, and Fatimid caliphates, the Almoravids and the Almohads, and various other smaller dynasties such as the Beni Hafs in Tunis, the Beni Ziyan in the central Maghreb, and the Beni Meren in Morocco. Their rule, for the most part, was not unenlightened. They allowed freedom of worship to such modest Christian communities as existed within their borders. In the 13th century, there was even a bishop of Fez, where Leo Africanus, whose writings remained for some four centuries one of Europe's principal sources of information about Islam, had served as a registrar in the Strangers' Hospital. He testified in about 1526 to the civility, humanity, and upright dealings of the barbarians, a civil people who prescribe laws and constitutions unto themselves, and were learned in the arts and sciences. It seems, moreover, that they normally enjoyed fairly close commercial relations with Sicily and the Italian mercantile republics, and were well known even to the English merchants of the 15th century, for whom Algiers was a good deal more easily accessible than Constantinople or even Venice. But although their rulers could prohibit piracy, they could never prevent pirate freebooters from setting sail, and the Christian victims, especially the Sardinians, Maltese, Genoese, and Greeks, gave as good as they got. Until the end of the 14th century, indeed, they gave rather better. They, rather than the Muslims, were the chief terrorists of the Mediterranean. Only with the coming of the large commercial fleets did their occupation lose something of its savor. Thenceforth, it is the Moorish corsairs who assume center stage. The 15th century, as we have seen, witnessed two cataclysmic events, one at each end of the Middle Sea. In the east, the fall of Constantinople in 1453, with the consequent closure of the Black Sea to Christian navigation, and in the west, the gradual expulsion of the Moors from Spain in the years following 1492. Both led to a proliferation of rootless vagabonds. In the east, Christians. In the west, Muslims. All of them ruined, disaffected, and longing for revenge. And many of them adopted the buccaneering life. The Christians would normally establish their bases in the central Mediterranean, in Sicily or Malta, or among the countless islands off the Dalmatian coast. The Muslims, on the other hand, could only join their co-religionists in North Africa. Between Tangier and Tunis, there were some 1,200 miles, and in what was, for the most part, a fertile and well-watered coastal strip, innumerable tideless natural harbors ideal for their purposes. And so the legend of the Barbary Coast was born. Of all the pirates of that coast, the two greatest were brothers, Arouj and Khizr, better known as Kheir ed-Din Barbarossa. Born on the island of Mytilene, the modern Lesbos, they were the sons of a retired Greek-born janissary, then working as a potter, and his wife, who was formerly the widow of a Greek priest. Since all janissaries had originally been Christians before their forcible conversion, the Barbarossa brothers possessed not a drop of Turkish, Arab, or Berber blood, a fact to which their famous red beards were further testimony. In his early youth, Arouj, the elder of the two, had taken part in an unsuccessful expedition against the Knights of St. John, during which he had been captured and forced to serve in their galleys. Ransomed, we had no idea by whom, he was soon afterwards entrusted with a privateer by merchants of Constantinople, and served under the Mameluk ruler of Egypt. Sometime during the very first years of the century, he and his brother appeared in Tunis with two galliots, basically open boats with about 17 oars aside, each oar manned by two or perhaps three rowers. And in 1504, in the channel that runs between the island of Elba and the Italian mainland, Arouj won his first major prizes, two papal galleys loaded to the gunwales with precious goods from Genoa. They were bound for Civitavecchia, but they never reached it. Boarded and captured, they were brought proudly back to Tunis. In the following years, several Spanish vessels were also attacked, with similar results. And at last, in 1509, Cardinal Jimenez dispatched the celebrated Don Pedro Navarro with no less than 90 ships and an army of 11,000, ostensibly to spread Christianity along the North African coast, but in fact to bring the miscreants to book. When Oran was captured at the cost of only 30 Spanish lives, 4,000 of its inhabitants were massacred in cold blood, and 5,000 carried off to Spain, together with plunder, valued at 500,000 gold ducats. In the year following, Bougie and Tripoli went the same way. But Arouj, who had by now taken over the island of Jerba, and his base of operations was growing steadily stronger. And in 1512, he responded to an appeal by the exiled ruler of Bougie, forced out by Don Pedro, to restore him in return for the free use of the port. After a week of heavy bombardment, the Spanish garrison was about to surrender when a lucky shot took off Arouj's left arm. The siege was raised, and the fleet returned to Tunis, though not without capturing a Genoese galleot on the way. The Genoese were shortly to have their revenge. Their admiral, Andrea Doria, sped with 12 galleys to Tunis, sacked the fortress, and captured half the pirate fleet. But Arouj, his wound healed, returned to the attack and in 1516 received another appeal, this time from Prince Salim of Algiers. The city had not been conquered by Don Pedro, but 2 years before, in an attempt to prevent the constant Algerian attacks on Spanish shipping, the Spaniards had fortified an offshore island in the bay known as Peñon, from which they virtually controlled the harbor, threatening all traffic in both directions. Arouche did not hesitate. Bad luck had prevented him from regaining Bougie, but Algiers was a far bigger prize and would, incidentally, make a superb capital for the great Barbary kingdom that had long been his dream. By now, Arouche was powerful enough to mobilize a fleet of 16 galleots under the command of his brother Kisser, and an army of some 6,000 men. With this, he marched along the coast of Algiers, pausing only at Churchill, some miles to the west, where another sea adventurer, a Turk named Kara Hassan, had carved out a little sultanate for himself and amassed a small army of Moors and Turks, together with a number of ships. These Barbarossa needed, but rather than negotiate an alliance with Kara Hassan, he found it simpler with a blow of his scimitar to strike off his head. Arrived in Algiers, he at once began a heavy bombardment on the island fortress. 3 weeks later, however, he had made little appreciable impact, and so, being clearly in danger of losing face with the prince, changed his plan. A few days later, Salim was murdered in his bath, and Arouche had himself formally proclaimed sultan. The people of Algiers saw all too clearly the mistake they had made in inviting Barbarossa to help them, and it was not long before they opened secret talks with the Spanish garrison on the Peñon to bring about his downfall. But Arouche, with his network of spies throughout the city, soon got wind of what was happening. One Friday, when all the leading citizens were gathered in the great mosque, the doors were slammed shut and the worshippers found themselves surrounded by armed men. One after another, they were bound with their own turbans and were then led to the main door to witness the beheading of the chief conspirators. News of the coup soon reached Spain, where Ximenes was seriously alarmed. In May 1517, he sent out his second expedition against Arouche. 10,000 men under the leadership of the country's leading admiral, Diego de Vera. Once again, Barbarossa acted quickly, falling on the Spaniards while they were still unloading, and before they had time to reform, he killed some 3,000 of them. The remainder hastily re-embarked and fled for their lives. Even then, luck was against them. Towards nightfall, a sudden storm sprang up and drove many of the ships ashore where Barbarossa's men were waiting. It was a dismally depleted fleet that struggled back to its homeland. A month later, the ruler of Tenes, a city some 90 miles west of Algiers, was foolhardy enough to march against the corsair. His army, in its turn, was smashed to bits, and although he himself managed to escape to the hills, a few days later his city fell to Arouche, who once more proclaimed himself sultan. The city of Tlemcen, 200 miles further to the west and some way inland, quickly followed. When Arouche entered it in September, the head of its former ruler was borne before him on a lance. With the exception of Oran, Bougie, and Peñon, and a few other fortresses along the coast, Arouche Barbarossa was now master of virtually all the territory that forms the modern Republic of Algeria. It had taken him just 13 years. But Oran was to prove his Achilles' heel. Soon after the arrival in Spain of Charles I, later the Emperor Charles V, in September 1517, the city's governor, the Marquis of Comares, had returned to Spain to pay him homage and to discuss the general situation in North Africa, which was now becoming desperate. The Barbarossas were growing more powerful with every month that passed. The few remaining Spanish possessions on the coast were increasingly threatened. Now, surely, was the moment to strike again, before it was too late. This time, however, the enemy's strength and military skill must not be underestimated. as they had so tragically been on previous occasions. The young king was quick to agree. He immediately gave orders for an expedition to be prepared through the coming winter. It was to sail in the early spring, when it had orders to track down Barbarossa and destroy him. This time, it was a veritable armada that reached Oran in the first months of 1518, and an army of trained veterans that at once set out for Tlemcen. Mistrusting the defenses of the city, Arouche sent an urgent appeal for additional men and equipment from the Sultan of Fez, but the Sultan prevaricated. Meanwhile, the Spanish army was approaching, and there was no time to be lost. Tlemcen would have to be sacrificed. Arouche had no choice but to retreat to Algiers. But probably, owing to his fruitless waiting for the aid from Fez that never came, he had left it too late. Comares learned of his departure and set off in pursuit. Arouche had excellent horses, but they were no match for the Spanish thoroughbreds, and through forced marches, the Spaniards steadily gained on him. It is said that Arouche scattered gold and jewels behind him to delay his pursuers, but Comares forbade his men to dismount and finally caught up with him as he and his army were fording a mountain river. Arouche and his vanguard had already crossed it, but he turned back to join the remainder who had not yet done so, thus presenting a united front to the Spanish force. It was on that riverbank that he made his last stand, and there, still laying about him with his one arm, that he was struck down in his 44th year. His end was worthy of all that had gone before. He had been fearless, sometimes reckless, perhaps the very first and greatest of those swashbuckling corsairs who were to blaze their trail through succeeding centuries. Of all his contemporaries, it was said that only Hernan Cortes was his equal for bravery. It might be added that in his own astonishing achievement, starting as he did a discredited foreigner without allies and in the teeth of local hostility and everything that Spain could hurl against him, creating through sheer force of character in a few short years a strong and durable North African state, only he was the equal of the greatest of the conquistadors. For the Marquis of Comares, the death of the first Barbarossa and the destruction of his army opened the way to Algiers. Had he marched on the city, it would surely have fallen, and with Algiers in Spanish hands, the rest of North Africa would soon have been his. But he did nothing of the kind. Instead, he returned directly to Oran, and the opportunity was lost to Spain for 300 years. Meanwhile, Kizer, or as we must now call him, Kheir ed-Din Barbarossa, took on the mantle of his brother. It was a hard act to follow, but Kheir ed-Din had never lacked confidence. He may not have had quite the panache of Arouche, but he possessed all his brother's ambition, all his courage, and arguably rather more statesmanship and political wisdom. It is unlikely, for example, that Arouche would ever have considered sending ambassadors to Constantinople to make a formal presentation of the new province of Algiers to the Sultan. For Selim I, who had conquered Egypt only the year before, here was an invaluable westward extension to his African empire. He instantly appointed Kheir ed-Din his Baylor Bey, or Governor General, and provided him with a guard of honor of 2,000 Janissaries. With their help, all the Spanish conquest except Oran and the nigh-impregnable Peñon outside the harbor of Algiers were regained. Next, alliances were sealed with all the principal Arab and Berber tribes of the interior. In a remarkably short time, the second Barbarossa, considerably more powerful than the first had ever been, dominated the central and western Mediterranean. Around him he gathered a splendid company of corsair captains. They included Dragut, another converted Christian, who became known as the Drawn Sword of Islam, Sinan, the Jew of Smyrna, who was suspected of the black arts because he could take a declination reading with a crossbow, the redoubtable Ed-Din Reis, known by the Spaniards as Cacha Diablo, and perhaps half a dozen others, all of them superb seamen. Between May and October of every year, no foreign vessel was safe from their attacks, nor did they hesitate to pass through the straits to the open Atlantic, where they would lie in wait for the Spanish galleons returning from the Caribbean to Cadiz. But it was not only treasure that they were looking for. Every bit as profitable were Christian prisoners, who could either be enslaved and set to work in the galleys, or occasionally ransomed for gold. One incident in particular illustrates the effect of the Barbary pirates in the Middle Sea. In 1529, Aidan Race set out with 14 small galleots on a raiding expedition to Majorca, where he heard of a large party of Moriscos, converted Muslims, who wished to escape from their Spanish masters and were ready to pay good money for a passage to North Africa. Landing secretly by night, he embarked 200 families and, with a considerable amount of treasure, set sail for home. It happened that at just that moment, there arrived a fleet of 8 large Spanish galleons under a certain General Portundo. It was returning from Genoa, whence Portundo had escorted Charles V to be crowned emperor by the Pope at Bologna, and carried numerous grandees who had attended the ceremony. Aidan quickly landed his passengers, then swung out to sea, attacked and boarded the flagship. In the hand-to-hand fighting that followed, Portundo was killed. By the time the battle was over, one of the galleons had escaped to Ibiza. The other 7 had all been captured. The Muslim galley slaves were released from their chains to be replaced at the oars by their erstwhile masters. The damaged ships were repaired, the Moriscos were re-embarked, and the 7 great prizes, with their distinguished passengers, for whom good fat ransoms would be expected, were towed back in triumph. At last, Barbarossa felt himself ready to tackle the Pinon. Situated as it was at the very entrance to Algiers Harbor, it had long been a menace to his shipping. But it was only now that he had sufficient heavy artillery to make the necessary impact. On 6 May 1560, the attack began. The fortress was bombarded day and night for 15 days before he ordered the final assault, by which time the men of the Spanish garrison had no fight left in them. The building was then dismantled, and Christian slaves were employed for the next 2 years to construct, using the stones, the huge mole which joins the island to the mainland and still protects the harbor on its western side. Why, in the first half of the 16th century, did the Muslim world enjoy such a degree of naval supremacy in the Mediterranean? First of all, because it had few Christian competitors. Venice and Genoa controlled the Adriatic, together with the Ionian Sea immediately to the south, but the Knights of St. John, the finest fighting seamen of their day, had been expelled from Rhodes in 1522 and found their new home in Malta only 7 years later. It would be some time before they could hope to regain their former influence and strength. Spain, as we have seen, did her best to play an active part, but her principal energies were directed towards the New World. Besides, Christianity remained hopelessly divided. If Spain and France, Pope and Empire, the Eastern and Western churches, the kingdoms of Naples and Sicily, and the princes of North Italy could have made common cause, the outlook for the subjects of the Sultan might have been grim indeed. But Europeans always seemed far more interested in killing one another than in making a united stand against the Turk. Islam, by contrast, remained virtually united. One Christian admiral only seemed able to hold his own. In 1532, the Genoese Andrea Doria won several victories over Ottoman fleets in Greek waters. Paradoxically, however, it was these successes that brought Barbarossa what was almost certainly the most glorious moment of his career. To Sultan Suleiman, it was all too clear that the Turkish navy was vastly inferior to that of the Corsair and must be drastically reorganized if it was to hold its own in the Mediterranean. Moreover, there was only one man who could do it. Thus it was that in the spring of 1533, a delegation from the Sublime Porte arrived in Algiers, commanding Kheir ed-Din to come at his earliest convenience to Constantinople. The corsair accepted with alacrity. As a loyal subject of the Sultan, which he undoubtedly was, he must have fully appreciated the honor that was being done him. But he also had reasons of his own. For some time, he had had his eye on Tunis, his immediate neighbor to the east. It had once been his and his brother's headquarters, but in recent years neither he nor Arouge had paid it any particular attention. In 1526, however, a new ruler of the Beni Hafs dynasty had come to the throne, after the murder of, it is said, 22 of his brothers. He had quickly proved a disaster, and by 1532, Barbarossa was receiving regular appeals from his friends in Tunis to assume power there himself. Before he could take such a step, however, he needed the Sultan's blessing. If he could also persuade Suleiman to provide him with arms and men, so much the better. He set sail the following August, laden with appropriate presents for the Sultan, which included, if we are to believe Sandoval, Bishop of Pamplona, some 200 young Christian women for his harem, each of them carrying in her hand a gift of gold or silver. And he was received in similar style. A few days later, with the title of Pasha, he was appointed member of the Divan and Captain General of the Fleet. He was to remain in Constantinople nearly a year, during which time he virtually created the Ottoman Navy. The French secretary in the city, Jean Chesneau, reported in 1543. The supremacy of Turkey at sea dates from Kheir ed-Din's first winter in the dockyards of this city. Over at Pera, the northeastern side of the Golden Horn, there is a shipyard on the shore where they both built and maintain galleys and other ships. Normally, there are 200 skilled master craftsmen working there. In charge of all this, there is a captain general, whom the Turks call the Baylor Bey of the sea, who also has charge of the navy when it goes out. Before he took charge, the Turks, apart from a few corsairs, knew nothing of the seaman's art. When they needed crews for a fleet, they went into the mountains of Greece and Anatolia and brought in shepherds, and put them to row in the galleys and to serve aboard the other ships. This was quite useless, for they knew neither how to row or to be sailors, or even how to stand upright at sea. For this reason, the Turks never made any showing. But all at once, Barbarossa changed the entire system. Inspiring his men with his own marvelous energy, he laid out 61 galleys during the winter, and was able to take to the sea with a fleet of 84 vessels in the spring. In July 1534, Kheir ed-Din Barbarossa led his new fleet out of the Golden Horn, through the Sea of Marmara and down the Hellespont into the Mediterranean. Rounding the toe of Italy, he seized and sacked Reggio, then passed through the Straits of Messina and headed up the coast towards Naples. Oddly enough, there was no reaction from the Spanish viceroy. Did he, one wonders, receive a secret message from the corsair, promising that if he met with no opposition, the city would be left untouched? At any rate, Naples was spared, and the fleet sailed on to Spurlonia, which proved rather less fortunate, the cream of its womanhood being seized and loaded onto the ships. Barbarossa, however, had set his sights on one woman in particular, a woman whom he saw as a very special gift to the Sultan, Giulia Gonzaga, the exquisite young widow of Vespasiano Colonna, generally considered the most beautiful woman of her day, painted by Sebastiano del Piombo and Titian, her praises sung by Ariosto and Tasso. She kept an elegant and cultivated little court in her palace at Fondi. This town lies some 12 miles inland from Terracina, and Kheir ed-Din, with his small raiding party, had hoped to take it and Giulia by surprise. Fortunately, she received warning a few minutes before their arrival and, still in her nightdress, made her escape with a single retainer, whom she later condemned to death on the grounds that he had taken advantage of her distress and been overbold. In the circumstances, one suspects, he probably had. Fondi, as might have been expected, paid the usual price. Laden with the captive women, most of them destined for the Turkish slave markets, and with loot from the pillaged towns, a few vessels now returned to Constantinople. They also carried the greater part of the Janissaries, made available by Sultan Selim, probably ordered home by Suleiman, who had gone to war with Persia and needed all the manpower he could lay his hands on. The bulk of the fleet, however, headed southward towards Tunis. For Barbarossa, his Italian expedition had been merely a preliminary, a harmless little exercise designed to impress the Sultan with his new fleet in general and his new admiral in particular. Now it was time for the serious business, the toppling of Muley Hassan and the annexation of his Tunisian kingdom. He arrived outside the harbor on 16 August and immediately began the bombardment, only to find that Muley Hassan had already taken flight. 2 days later, with 1,000 local irregulars, the fugitive ruler made a half-hearted effort to return, but when the corsairs opened fire a second time, he once again hastily withdrew. All that winter, Barbarossa kept his men busy, strengthening the harbor defenses and building an imposing new fortress, big enough to accommodate a garrison of 500 men. He need not have bothered, for this time he had overreached himself. Perhaps when planning the Tunis operation, he had underestimated the probable reaction of Charles V and the emperor's power to retaliate. In any case, he had made a serious mistake. A glance at the map will show that Charles could not conceivably accept his annexation of a country less than 100 miles away from the two prosperous ports of western Sicily, Trapani and Marsala, and only very little more from Palermo itself. The idle and pleasure-loving Muley Hassan had constituted no danger, but now that Barbarossa was in Tunis, the emperor's own hold on Sicily was seriously threatened. As soon as he heard the news, he began to plan an immense expedition to recover the city. The invasion fleet would number ships from Spain, Naples, Sicily, Sardinia, Malta, where the Knights of St. John had recently established themselves following their eviction from Rhodes, and Genoa. Andrea Doria would once again be in command. The emperor himself, with the Spanish contingent, estimated at some 400 ships, sailed from Barcelona at the end of May 1535 to the agreed rendezvous at Cagliari in Sardinia, where they arrived on 10 June and picked up another 200. Then, on the 13th, they turned to the south, and on the following day, hove to in the roadstead outside the port of Tunis. Against such an armada, Kheireddin Barbarossa knew that there was little hope of retaining his hold on the city. Having no intention, however, of losing more ships than necessary, he had taken the precaution of sending 15 of his best vessels along the coast to Bonn, about halfway to Algiers, where they could be kept safely in reserve. He and his men fought valiantly, as they always did, but on 14 July, exactly a month after Charles's arrival, the fortress of La Goleta that defended the inner harbor was stormed by the Knights of St. John, and a week later the 12,000 Christian captives who were being held in the city somehow smashed their way to freedom and flung themselves on their erstwhile captors. Tunis was effectively lost, and now it was Barbarossa's turn to flee. In company with his two fellow captains, Aydin Reis and Sinan, and as many other of his men who were able to follow him, he slipped out of the city and made for Bonn. At this point, Charles should have ordered his army to leave at once in pursuit and force Kheireddin into a pitched battle. Had he done so, he might have destroyed the corsair forever and the emperor's 600 ships, should have had no difficulty in preventing him from escaping by sea. But the soldiers, and probably the sailors too, were far too busy raping and plundering, as the rules of war allowed them to do for 3 days and nights. Having agreed to pay the emperor an annual tribute, Muley Hassan was then formally reinstated in the empty shell of his city, and the Spaniards, having repaired and refortified La Goleta, declared it Spanish territory and equipped it with a permanent garrison. The expedition, the victorious Christians all agreed, had been a huge success. Tunis was once again in friendly hands. Sicily was secure. Thousands of their co-religionists had been freed from captivity. And, best of all, perhaps, the previously invincible Barbarossa had been conclusively defeated. They could all return to their various homelands well satisfied with what they had achieved. Or so they thought. The emperor actually sent Andrea Doria on an expedition westward along the coast to find the fugitive corsair and bring him to book. He did not know his man. It was typical of Kheraddin Barbarossa that instead of slinking back to Algiers, as they had assumed he would, he put in at Beaune, only to collect more ships and supplies before immediately heading north for the Balearic Islands. As his squadron approached, the islanders understandably assumed it to be part of the imperial fleet returning to Barcelona, an impression confirmed when it was seen to be flying the imperial colors. There was no resistance. Therefore, when it glided soundlessly into the harbor of Mahon, in the southeast corner of Menorca, a Portuguese merchantman, which was lying there at anchor, fired a friendly salute. Then suddenly, the squadron opened fire. The Portuguese, taken by surprise, defended themselves as well as they could, but their ship was easily captured. It was only a matter of hours before the whole port, and indeed the whole city, was sacked and destroyed. In the late autumn of 1535, Barbarossa made his second journey to Constantinople. He was never to return to North Africa. His final years were to be spent less as a corsair than as admiral of the Ottoman fleet, confounding the Sultan's enemies, notably the Spaniards, Venetians, and Genoese. Until this time, Venice had been allowed to pursue her mercantile activities largely unopposed. Suleiman's brilliant Grand Vizier Ibrahim Pasha is believed to have been born a Venetian citizen on the Dalmatian coast. Certainly after his forcible conversion to Islam, he always kept a soft spot for Venice in his heart and did his best to respect her Mediterranean possessions. In the spring of 1536, however, Ibrahim was murdered at the instigation of Suleiman's wife, Roxalana, who wanted his post for her son-in-law, Rustem Pasha. Henceforth, the Serenissima would be as open to attack as were Spain and Genoa. That same year, an imperial fleet under Andrea Doria captured 10 Turkish merchantmen off Messina, following up this coup with an intrepid raid on a section of the Ottoman fleet off Paxos in the Ionian Sea. The Sultan, determined that these two insults should be properly avenged, conceived a daring plan. In the spring of 1537, he personally would lead an army of 20,000 men through Thrace and down the Balkan Peninsula as far as Valona, in what is now Albania. Meanwhile, Barbarossa would sail with a fleet of 100 ships to the same port. There he would embark the army and carry it across to Brindisi, whose governor had been suborned and had promised to open the city gates. Unfortunately for Suleiman, this plan misfired when the governor's treachery was discovered just in time. With both his army and navy already in the Adriatic, the Sultan had to decide quickly on an alternative. While he was deliberating, Barbarossa staged a series of lightning raids along the coast of Apulia, returning with the usual shiploads of treasure and slaves, to learn that his master had decided to besiege the island of Corfu. The largest of the Ionian islands, Corfu had technically been a Venetian colony since the Fourth Crusade. In the distribution of the former Byzantine territories of 1204, old Doge Dondolo had laid claim to a huge share, for which the Republic had no real appetite nor any means of properly digesting it. She had, therefore, had no choice but to leave the Ionian Islands to the Greek and Italian adventurers who occupied them. Since then, Corfu had fallen into several successive hands. At first occupied by the Venetian family of Venier, it had at various times been held by the despotate of Epirus, Manfred of Sicily, and the House of Anjou, returning to Venice in 1386. Unlike all its neighboring islands except Paxos, however, it had never been taken by the Ottomans and, incidentally, never would be. In recent years, it had been protected by its Venetian status, but Ibrahim Pasha was now dead, and to Suleiman, with his huge army, it must have seemed easy prey. He landed his entire army and all his ordnance, some 30 cannon, including a gigantic 50-pounder, the largest in the world at the time, surrounded the chief citadel of the town and began to pound it into submission. Fortunately, Corfu's defenses were strong. The town, halfway up the eastern coast of the island, lay between and below the high citadel, crowning the rocky peninsula that juts out towards the shores of Albania, commanding the approaches from both land and sea. Within this citadel was a garrison of some 2,000 Italians and roughly the same number of Corfiots, together with the crews of such Venetian vessels as happened to be in port at the time. Food and ammunition were in plentiful supply. Morale was excellent. It needed to be, for the defenders now found, to their dismay, that they were faced not just with an attack from the sea, but with a combined naval and military operation, carefully planned and on a considerable scale. The devastation suffered by the local peasants, as well as the ordinary citizens, was appalling, but the citadel, despite constant battering from Turkish cannon on land and sea, and several attempts to take it by storm, somehow stood firm. Then, mercifully, came the rain. Corfu has always been famous for the ferocity of its storms, and those which burst upon it in the early days of September 1537 seem to have been exceptional even by local standards. The cannon became immovable in the mud. Dysentery and malaria spread through the Turkish camp. After barely 3 weeks' siege, the Ottoman army re-embarked on the 15th, leaving a triumphant, if still somewhat incredulous, garrison to celebrate its victory. But the war was not over. Barbarossa's fleet was still active, and the other Mediterranean harbors and islands that remained in Venetian hands were not as defensible as Corfu. Many of them, though theoretically under the protection of the Republic, were in fact ruled by private families who had no means of staving off any sustained attack. But Barbarossa was remorseless. One by one they fell. Nauplia and Malvasia, now Monivasia, on the east coast of the Peloponnese. Then the islands, Scyros, Aegina, Patmos, Ios, Paros, Astapaliae, all of them considerably nearer to the Turkish mainland than to Venice, whose fleet was now blocked by the throng of Ottoman ships in the Adriatic Narrows. The most serene republic had been brought to her knees, and it was Kheireddin Barbarossa who was responsible for her humiliation. No wonder that when he returned to Constantinople, it was to a hero's welcome, such as had never been known. But he gave as good as he received, 400,000 gold pieces, 1,000 young women, and 1,500 youths. There was also a personal present to the Sultan, 400 more youths, dressed in scarlet and carrying vessels of gold and silver, bales of precious silks and embroidered purses almost bursting with gold coins. For the Venetians, by the time the triumphant Barbarossa sailed into the Golden Horn, the victory of Corfu had already gone sour. Every week was now bringing them reports of new defeats, new losses. In 1538, he was again on the warpath, terrorizing first Scyros and Sciathos in the Sporades, and then Andros in the Cyclades, and many smaller islands nearby. From the larger and more important islands, he exacted an annual tribute. The smaller were obliged to provide manpower for the galleys, since the vast fleet that he was building needed literally thousands of oarsmen, of whom there was a chronic shortage. He then turned south to Crete, still Venice's chief colony in the eastern Mediterranean. The fortifications of the capital, Candia, proved impregnable, but over 80 villages along the coast and several of the outlying islands were not so lucky. Meanwhile, the European powers seemed incapable of forming alliances that were not poisoned by mutual suspicion and petty bickering almost before they began. In the summer of 1538, one such attempt, embarked upon by the emperor, the pope, and Venice, with all the fervor of a crusade and a degree of optimism such that the participants actually made advanced plans for the division of the Ottoman Empire between them, ended not as they had imagined, with the capture of Constantinople, but with a resounding victory for Barbarossa. It was while he was ranging along the south coast of Crete, and he received reports of a huge combined fleet heading south down the Adriatic towards the Ionian Islands. The Venetian contingent alone consisted of 81 ships, some under sail, but the majority oared galleys under one of the Republic's leading admirals, Vincenzo Capello. The papal contribution of another 36 galleys was commanded by another Venetian, Marco Grimani, and these were joined when they reached Corfu by another 30 from Spain. Yet even this was only the vanguard. Expected shortly were the 49 vessels sent by the emperor, which had been delayed pending the arrival of his secret weapon, a further squadron of 50 so-called galleons, literally large galleys, square-sailed and heavily armed, which had proved their worth in the Atlantic and the New World, but which had never yet been seen in the Mediterranean. Predictably, Charles had entrusted the command of the whole enterprise to his trusted admiral, Andrea Doria. To set against this, Barbarossa could muster about 150 ships of his own under Dragut, Sinan, and several other former corsairs of long experience and tested courage. Here, too, was a formidable force. If numbers were all, however, it would have been no match for his opponents. But the Turkish fleet was united. The Christian was anything but. No Venetian, for a start, would willingly submit to being commanded by a Genoese. Nor was there any love lost between Italians and Spaniards. There were differences, too, in long-term objectives. Capello was interested, above all, in protecting the Ionian Islands, commanding, as they did, the gateway to the Adriatic. Grimani's chief concern was Italy's western seaboard, the ports of Civitavecchia and Ostia, and indeed Rome itself, only a few miles from Ostia up the Tiber. The Spaniards cared for neither of these things. Spain was too far away. They doubtless hoped to teach the Turks a lesson, but when that was done, they wanted above all to go home with any prizes that might be obtainable. Discord, in short, could be virtually guaranteed, and tempers were not improved by the continued delay of Doria and his fleet, thanks to which the enforced inactivity at Corfu was prolonged from days into weeks. At last, Marco Grimani could stand it no longer. Leading the papal squadron out of Corfu, he sailed south to Prevesa, at the entrance of the Bay of Arta. This huge inlet of the Ionian Sea is in fact more of a gulf than a bay. Covering some 250 square miles, it is entered by a narrow winding channel in places only a quarter of a mile wide. It thus provides an extraordinary natural harbor, and Grimani's purpose may well have been to satisfy himself that the Turkish fleet was not lying in wait there. It proved not to be. On the other hand, the fortress of Prevesa was fully garrisoned and disposed to fight, and its cannon inflicted considerable damage on the raiders before they escaped to safety. Had Grimani delayed his little expedition by another few days, he would have found his worst fears confirmed. Barely had his squadron disappeared over the northern horizon, then Barbarossa's fleet sailed up from the south and turned straight into the bay. Here, off Actium, at the very spot where Octavian had met Mark Antony 1,570 years before, he prepared for battle. It was not until 22 September that Andrea Doria finally arrived at Corfu with his galleons. By this time, reports of Barbarossa's movements had reached the island, and on the 25th, the entire fleet hove to off Prevesa. But what was it to do next? To sail up the narrow channel in line under the guns, first of the fortress and then of the Turkish fleet, would have been suicidal. In the circumstances, it would have been better to attack the fortress, capture it, and turn its guns against the enemy. Doria, however, refused to consider such a course. Any serious losses on land might disastrously weaken his fleet if a sea battle were to follow. He knew, too, that this was the season of the equinoctial gales, when the Mediterranean was at its most treacherous. In the event of a sudden storm, and September storms could blow up in half an hour from a clear blue sky, he might be obliged to withdraw the fleet to some lee shore, leaving any land forces unsupported. The situation looked suspiciously like a stalemate. It was doubtless for this reason that, on the night of the 26th, Doria gave the order to weigh anchor and head south into Turkish waters. Barbarossa, fully conscious of his enemy's strength, but with no idea of his destination, would have no option but to pursue him, and the two fleets could meet in the open sea. To this degree, Doria was right. As his ships sailed down the west coast of the island of Lucas, the Turks did indeed emerge from the Bay of Arta and follow them. His problem was that his fleet, consisting as it did partly of oared galleys and partly of sailing galleons, was impossible to keep together. When the wind was fresh, the galleons swept ahead. When it suddenly changed or dropped, the galleys either overtook them or threw away their advantage, and, to the immense relief of the oarsmen, waited for them to catch up. Thus it was that by the time his flagship was rounding the southwestern cape of Lucas, some of the heaviest galleons were lying almost becalmed, only a few miles from their point of departure. And then the wind did indeed change. On the morning of the 28th, it was blowing from due south, and the fleet was strung out all along the west coast of the island. This surely would have been the moment for Doria to return, with all his sails set to the north, regroup his ships, and meet the Turks head-on. Inexplicably, he remained where he was. Meanwhile, the Ottoman fleet, almost entirely oared, rounded the northern tip of Lucas, Barbarossa in the center, with Dragut commanding the right wing and Salares the left. There, dead ahead of them, was the largest, strongest, heaviest, and therefore, in the conditions prevailing, the slowest of all the Allied vessels. She was known as the Galleon of Venice, commanded by one of the Republic's most promising young captains, Alessandro Culdomer. She carried a huge weight of cannon, as much as the average coastal fortress, and was well able to defend herself. But, sheltered as she now was by the mountains of Lucas, she was immobile. Her commander dispatched a fast pinnace to his admiral with an urgent appeal for help. Barbarossa attacked, but Condulmer gave as good as he got, indeed rather better, waiting until the attacking Turkish ships came within point-blank range, and then blasting them one after another out of the water. He knew, however, that he could not hold out indefinitely against such an enemy. Everything depended on the swift arrival of Doria's galleys, but they did not come. With the wind behind them, which it was, they could have made the journey in 3 hours at the most. We know, too, that both Vincenzo Capello and Marco Grimani pressed their admiral hard to sail with his whole fleet to the rescue. Dusk was falling when he eventually agreed. Even then, he insisted on taking the fleet in a wide arc to the west. So, Condulmer was obliged to fight on unaided, demonstrating, incidentally, that a sturdy galleon with a highly trained, well-disciplined crew, even when becalmed, was a more effective fighting weapon than any number of oared galleys. Consequently, he, his ship, and most of his men survived, but he could not affect the outcome of the battle. By the time Barbarossa turned his ships back to Prevesa, at sunset, he had captured at least 2 galleys, 1 Venetian and 1 from the Papal squadron, and 5 Spanish sail. Doria, with